KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
A little dancing from 94.9 KUOW Seattle. I'm Marcy Silman. Steve Scherr's on a well-deserved sabbatical for the next 5 months. I'm going to be keeping his chair warm until then. Well, news-wise, it has been a wild, wild week. On Monday, a group of NBA team owners voted 7-0 against a plan to relocate the Sacramento Kings to Seattle. Once again, the state legislature ended its official session, but not its official business, so they're going to come back in a couple weeks. And oh yeah, May Day, it almost came and went without violence, but not quite. These are some of the events that made headlines, and joining us, as they do every Friday, our esteemed panel of journalists. Alphabetically, Joni Balter, assistant political editor for the Seattle Times, Knute Berger, the Mossback at crosscut.com, blogging at Seattle Magazine, and Eli Sanders, associate editor at The Stranger. Nice to see all three of you.
Nice. Good morning, you. Marcy.
Well, let's start at the most recent with May Day. This is like a few weeks after a big report criticizing how the police handled the 2012 May Day melee came out. And what we saw, or at least what I saw live on three local television stations, were police not doing the same thing that they did last year.
It was a different approach. As a matter of fact, if you watch CNN, you know, the Seattle made, if that's the right word, national TV as well. So we have sort of a reputation for this a little bit. It seemed like it was a completely different event from the year before. There were very peaceful and protests earlier in the day. It was almost like that eerie, nothing happened. It's going to be quiet. And then as the evening came, I was downtown also at that time, and I looked, in Belltown actually, and I looked toward Macy's and saw things were starting to heat up. But this was this effort by police to use their bicycles as crowd control, as fences, as protectors, and also sort of crowd splitters, if that's the right way to say it, and to drive the crowd back up to Capitol Hill, which may have something to do with why the downtown folks were so pleased, I guess, with the police handling of things. As always, there were a few, I don't know what to call them, wild people who seemed to be from out of town and just throwing rocks and bottles just because they could.
Well, Eli, you ran, I think you just fortuitously ran into somebody and did a little interview. This was somebody from the later group, I'm assuming.
Right. And one thing to amplify on what Joni was describing is a big difference this year is that the so-called black bloc protesters did not mingle in and sort of hide among the larger May Day protests, which is what happened last year. And a lot of people were very upset about it. It was using the cover of a peaceful protest to engage in other actions that were not part of the peaceful protest march. So this year, they really had a clear division. The peaceful protest happened in the middle of the day, middle of the afternoon, 3,000 people, three blocks long, walking through downtown Seattle, and, you know, articulating very clearly some important points about immigration reform. Unfortunately, that then got overshadowed by the separate march, which left from Seattle Central later in the day and resulted in these clashes with police. And one of the people who was arrested last night, while I was biking down to Art Walk, I just saw him on the sidewalk out in front of the King County Administration Building. So I did a little interview with him. It's posted on Slog today. And he said that he was at the protest because he was upset about police brutality. The instance of police brutality that he cited is one that has pretty much been discredited, or at least could never be substantiated. The claim by someone connected to the Occupy movement about a year ago that she was pushed around by police and later miscarried. That could never be substantiated, but it clearly circulated at least among this man's friends, and he ended up at this protest. But you'll notice it is hard to draw a direct line between that and any of the more typical May Day concerns.
Well, one thing watching the coverage on television, which was very bizarre, I felt like it was the O.J. Simpson era where they, you know, had the helicopters following his car. We're watching this thing, but I had no context then for who the ralliers at 6:30 in the evening actually were? Were they the Black Bloc? Were they self-described anarchists? Were they just disaffected youth? I mean, who?
Well, this is one of the problems. It's, first of all, very hard to apply labels to anarchists if the, you know, if all of them would even accept the label of anarchists, all the people in this.
That's the whole point. If you're an anarchist, sure.
You don't want to be connected. You don't have a group exactly.
But it creates a big problem in terms of communicating to the larger population, which is traditionally at least what large protest marches are about. And so, yeah, people come away, you know, befuddled just like you. What is the point other than the clash with police? And it I don't think it's been effectively communicated if there was one.
Before we went on the air, Knut, you were comparing, this is a microcosm, but comparing what happened on May Day to the WTO, where people with very defined messages every day of WTO week was supposed to be a different theme. And that kind of got hijacked again by people who had maybe not quite as clear a message that they wanted to send.
Yeah, well, one of the things that happened is remembering back to WTO is that there were tens of thousands of peaceful protesters, even people who were protesting illegally by blocking streets and whatnot were doing more of had a more of a sit-in kind of approach, and there were they were used. As it was suggested earlier, they were used as cover for anarchists and other people who wanted to create trouble. And the problem was that whatever the message was of WTO, which was, you know, involved groups from all over the world, it was about the environment, it was about the world economy, it was about all kinds of things. Whatever it was about got completely hijacked by, a news box going through the window of a Starbucks, that kind of thing. And so it's very effective for those people who want to create disruptions. It's very how much media time did the anarchists get as compared with the issue of immigration? I mean, that's the problem. The other part of it is you really are talking about a relatively small group of, you know, hooligans, people who are don't represent even the wider group who are, you know, supporting what May Day is all about, which is not only social justice, but labor and health care and all those other things. And so, I think we have to keep it in perspective. Another lesson from WTO is the police cannot and the political forces downtown cannot afford to infuriate the downtown retailers. You have to protect that. You know, the sort of downtown area, which is, I think, one of the reasons. I mean, after WTO, police departments all over the country came up with tactics for how to break up large demonstrations and isolating protesters and that kind of thing. The Downtown Association was sort of very happy with the way the police handled May Day. That was not true of Paul Schell after WTO.
Right.
Well, compare and contrast. If you remember WTO, 6th Avenue was the place where some of the tear gassing began, and everyone was allowed during WTO to mass in sort of the major arteries of downtown. This, with this bicycle business, was much more, you know, break up the groups, don't let any sort of huge mass, critical mass assemble. And that's what they use the bicycles for. You're exactly right. One thing that you said there was that, you know, this was supposed to be about immigration and workers' rights. But if you read the stories, who gets the top five or six paragraphs? The rock throwers. Why are you throwing rocks? I don't know. You know, I'm mad at some diffused kind of nothingness. You know, it's just because we go, you know, after WTO, in Europe, when there were other meetings of the WTO and other places, in Italy, they were called the Popoli di Seattle, the Seattle people. In other words, this is how people who go to protests in Seattle behave. Get it? So we have this sort of weird reputation.
And it's actually not how the majority of people who go to protests in Seattle do behave. And again, I just think it's terribly unfortunate that the message of the peaceful protesters gets drowned out. But just one other thing to say on Joni's point, you know, it's not just bicycles. It was the little bombs, and I forget what
they're called.
Bang blasts.
Yep.
Flash bang.
Flash bangs.
No, but their flash bangs are ones that don't have tear gas in them. I just read that in the Seattle Times this morning.
They have some sort of irritant.
Take it to the bank then.
It's like pepper spray.
Yeah, I've been around them when I was covering some of the Occupy protests down at the port, and they definitely release some sort of gas that makes you not want to stay in the area. And what, you know, what the police were doing was something actually similar to the WTO protests, driving people up to back up to Capitol Hill. And you remember then the outcry from Capitol Hill was, why did you create mayhem in our neighborhood? And, you know, it's a problem probably without a good solution for anyone. If you decide that the protesters are going to be pushed out of downtown, you have to push them somewhere. But there was a really self-defeating aspect of the group that moved up to Capitol Hill in that, you know, a window at Bill's off Broadway, which is a small local business. I like defy anyone to connect them to any of the grievances aired by any of the protesters, had its window smashed out.
There were three window smashings. It's true that Capitol Hill was a bit sacrificed in this situation. I thought the owner of Bill's off Broadway was pretty good natured. He said, how do you connect us to anything that these folks are supposedly riled up about? There was a disconnect there.
He still has to pay to have his window fixed, which is unfortunate. Another question I have, and one of our listeners has it as well, is what role did the media play in fomenting any of this violence? Because as you pointed out, the violence got the top billing. The peaceful protests were, you know, a little bit later in the story. We didn't go live at 3 o'clock in the afternoon on every television station to watch people, you know, marching in the sunshine.
Well, that is that double-edged thing. You know, the media has to be there to record what is going to happen. And so, and many report, there was one reporter who was injured in all of this. The media had to be there. So then when they cut to them from their newscast, they have to say something. And it sort of does have this, well, I don't see anything yet, do you? You know, and then yet comes later in the evening.
Particularly with television media, which I think is what we should be talking about here, the fomenting aspect comes exactly from that creation of this great suspense. Is there going to be violence? And you can hear, you know,
2:07.
Yeah, there's a kind of anticipation and buildup toward it in a way that creates a kind of, you can feel a sort of disappointment, I think, or a potential disappointment from the television media, you know, if there wasn't going to be violence, but then an incredible anger when there is disruption. And we were talking about that before, where a lot of the television anchors, you know, spent the airtime while they were showing these images just scolding the protesters on air in really non-objective terms, I would say.
Well, the protest is also coming at a very politically charged time for the police department. You had the report that just came out about last year. You have the Justice Department's oversight and to some degree some civilian oversight of the police department problems there. It's an issue in the mayor's race. In a debate earlier this week, there was a funny moment when the mayoral candidates were asked to write down, you know, what they thought about whether is May Day going to go well this year or not was one of the questions. And Tim Burgess, who's one of the challengers to Mayor Mike McGinn, held up a little sign that said, "Ask the mayor," you know, basically putting all of May Day success or failure on him. And so, you know, that plays into to the media focus on it in terms of it not only is great TV to show people throwing rocks and police show, you know, tear gassing people, but and you have all the tools to do it, helicopters and stuff. But there's also the issue of a heightened awareness that the stakes of it are fairly high and a few people could, you know, really, you know, derail things.
Somebody writes in before, Joni, before I let you weigh in, foment might be too much a word. And there's a suggestion that the television stations incited as opposed to fomented. Okay, Joni.
I simply wanted to say that if they were all sort of the mayoral candidates leading up to the event were ready to blame McGinn if it didn't go well, are they ready to say it went well?
All right, hold that question because we're going to talk about mayoral candidates after this short break. You're listening to our regular Friday panel of journalists, Joni Balter, Eli Sanders, Knute Berger, I'm Marcy Silman here on 94.9 KUOW.
Mm-hmm.
56 degrees and sunny in Seattle. Forecast says expect sun all day. High temperature this afternoon of 72. Tomorrow, sunny, 77. On Sunday, sunny, possibly getting up to 80.
Support for KUOW comes from Tiny's Organic Farm, providing a variety of fresh organic fruits and vegetables. Now introducing the Paleo Box for adherence to the Paleolithic lifestyle approach to eating. Local delivery available from Zarly.com. More information at Zarly, Zarly.com/Tiny's Organic.
It's 10:20. I'm Bernard Ouellette. A conversation about new energy technologies and their implications for the environment and American energy independence this morning at 11:15.
From KUOW Seattle, I'm Marcy Silman. It is Friday, and our panel of journalists is here, as always, or almost always, to talk about the week's news. Knut Berger, Eli Sanders, Joni Balter. And you can email us weekday@kuow.org. Joni, left a dangling question before the break about the mayor. This past Monday, I believe all eight mayoral candidates, if I'm not mistaken, gathered in Georgetown for their first pre-primary debate, and Knut was in the front row, a front row seat, ringside seats.
Yeah, I was hoping, it was sort of like ringside. I was hoping for the, you know, blood and sweat and that kind of thing.
It had a kind of a, as you wrote about it, a sort of weird format.
Well, it did. I mean, it wasn't the first debate, but it was the first televised debate. I think it was the second time they'd all gotten together.
Uh-huh.
C.R. Douglas, who occasionally appears here, was the moderator. And the format was sort of where they had a bunch of set questions that everyone had to answer by writing with a magic marker on a piece of paper and holding up their answer, yes, no, maybe, whatever.
That's a version of the lightning round to make it sort of move faster.
Exactly.
Because when you have eight candidates lined up.
Should we raise taxes? No.
Right.
Should we have bike lanes? No.
Each candidate then had a Trump card, which was a giant like playing card with Donald Trump on it. And the Trump card.
Bloomberg?
They determined the questions in advance, and then they would ask a question of, say, three candidates. And if another candidate wanted to jump in and answer that question, they could use their Trump card to get in. But you could only do that once. And so it's very difficult to get into substance in those things because there are too many people and mm-hmm. whatnot. The impressive thing was there were three legislative districts that had sponsored the debate. They put out 120 chairs. There were well over 200 people there. It was just absolutely packed. This was sort of the first chance that a lot of people had to see everybody in one place. And you do begin to get a sense of personality. You get a sense of how well they handle questions, who the candidates that seemed more serious than others are. So it was a really a terrific first start. And subsequently this week, they've done at least two or three other.
So who are the candidates that seem more serious than others?
Well, the candidate who's most serious is probably the least likely to win, and that's Mary Martin, the socialist workers candidate. She was sort of the Debbie Downer of the whole.
I saw you use that phrase. Nobody wants to be called Debbie Downer.
Well, she's not really running as an individual. She kept referring to we with the socialist workers, and the answer to every question was had to do with quoting Karl Marx or something. It was. Allowing the workers and farmers to run everything on an international scale. So she had a particular, but she was probably the most serious. Everybody took it seriously. I think that there were a number of journalists there and people in the audience who were most favorably impressed with Bruce Harrell. Bruce Harrell did a really good job. He connected with people. He answered some questions really well that some of the other candidates fumbled.
The one he did so well on was in lack of equal pay for women.
Mm-hmm.
And so, there's two female candidates in it. They both coincidentally have the last name Martin. But the person, from everything I've read, is the person who said, I'm working on this, was Bruce Harrell. And everybody else said, meet my daughters. It could be better. We got to fix this. He had actually made the phone call, right?
Which is an especially great moment for Harrell because the knock on him is that he's not as engaged as he could be, doesn't have a lot of meaningful legislation going. And so he could really point to something here and, hit out of a park that every candidate should have been able to hit out of the park.
Well, at this point, is it too early to really, you know, I've seen polls, but is it too early to say this one's the front runner? I mean, is the mayor still going to be one of two?
I think that's the growing consensus, is the mayor is probably going to make it through the primary. I mean, there was, of course, when everybody got into the race, it was because they thought he was going to be toast.
Pre-primary toast.
Yeah. and certainly he has to still make his case. But I think he's a strong campaigner. He has some very positive things happening in the city, some of which he's responsible for, some of which he's not. But, you know, you have an improving economy. The city is going to start seeing budget surpluses. You know, he was mayor during a tough time. And I think one of the cases that McGinn is going to be making for himself, and he already is basically saying to the other people on the panel, where do you differ from me? You know, we all want density. We all want a green city. We're all for bikes. We're all, you know, where am I? Where are you different? The argument the counter argument to that is not so much about policy. It's about getting along with people. It's about the style of leadership. And mm-hmm. every single one of the other candidates are beating him up on that, though they back into it. You know, they say, well, we need to return a less combative situation to City Hall, or, you know, we need to listen to people. It's a veiled critique, which is going to get a lot sharper in the weeks ahead.
Eli?
I think there are two things that are entirely independent of these forums that it will be interesting to see their impact on this race. One is May Day that we were just discussing. Mm-hmm. I mean, the WTO was such a turning point for Paul Schell, and the handling that people, you know, attributed a lot to McGinn, even though it's the police department, right, but he's in charge of the police department, of last year's May Day rally has been a big issue for him. So how do people react to this year's handling? I think actually in the city at large, this will benefit McGinn. And then the other question that we'll probably pick up later in the hour is the outcome with the Sonics.
We will indeed pick that up soon. You want to weigh in on candidates, Joni, before
Oh, sure.
We go to basketball?
Okay, and this will get us to basketball, perhaps. So everybody likes a winner, right? Mm. So Mike McGinn started out, I think it was last week, where he was like, I'm going to save the fireworks. So he gets himself a win, because in July, when everybody says, oh, there are indeed fireworks, you know, he'll have a moment where he stands there and says, I'm so glad we saved them for the next
with
3 years.
Fireworks exploding.
Fireworks exploding. Hopefully not some of the other devices that were used. But so that's one thing. But he was also hoping and expecting to win on the NBA, which is now way more protracted and way more complicated. Some people say that game is over. We'll get to that in a sec. Mm-hmm. But so then you move along. And so by most logic, you know, it'll be McGinn against somebody. That's what he's saying. That's what a lot of people are saying. So who?
Yeah.
So
who?
So among them, there's many candidates. That's one of the phenomenon this year that State Senator Ed Murray, city council members Tim Burgess, Bruce Harrell are in there. And you have to look at how these folks are going to play. I sometimes think that State Senator Ed Murray benefits from news coverage that says Senator Murray, meaning the other one, because the name Murray is around quite a bit. But the other candidates, you know, have things going. A lot of people are coming out of this saying Bruce Harrell did well, or Tim Burgess had a good answer to this or that.
Well, Tim Burgess also, as last I read, had raised the most money.
And that's
all
a
these
factor
people.
As well. Some people don't need as much money for name familiarity, so that is the way that works.
Also, Ed Murray has been stymied by the fundraising freeze during the legislative session, and they're on a, I think, 2-week break right now in which he can fundraise. So it's going to be very interesting to see what his numbers are coming out of that.
So these 2 weeks he can raise money,
I believe,
and then he goes back.
Yes, correct, until May 13th.
And the other thing he can do is immerse himself in Seattle politicking. He can go to these forums. He was very nervous on Monday night. It was interesting because you think, well, Ed Murray's very experienced. He wasn't in his home district, but he's in his home, you know, his town. And, you know, he's used to Olympia politics. He's immersed in that. He's got to learn the city kind of at a different level and get more comfortable. I didn't feel like he was sort of on his message, but you could see parts of it, you know, where he talked about how I have gotten things passed that were started out really unpopular. Gay marriage. You know, I got a transportation bill through, the biggest in state history. I had a committee of 29 Republicans and Democrats that I herded to get this this transportation bill passed. Your city count, this city council only has 9 people on it, and I can herd 29. And I so you could see how he was beginning to shape the arguments. You can see on the city council side. You know, I think Tim Burgess hasn't found his. He has a great kind of demeanor, and you know, sort of mature, smart, sensible persona, but his campaign seems like it's a little too much of the. Well, yeah, we did that, but you know, McGinn proposed that, but I made it better. You know, he had the Sonics deal, but I made it a little better. He had South Lake Union Plan. I made it a little better. You know, that's not what Seattle responds to. Seattle wants more vision. The guy with a contrasting vision, if you want, who contrasts with most of the other people, is Steinbrück. And even though Peter's for density and all that other thing, all those other things, you know, Peter's, you know, he's an apostate on the arena. He made a big deal out of that. And he's appealing, I think, to a different sector of the electorate than the sort of consensus electorate. But whether that, I don't know whether that'll catch fire or not. But that's it's a clear contrast.
I think he has his kickoff, his campaign kickoff this weekend, if I'm not mistaken. I believe I got some email.
Yeah, he's got a big function on Sunday. Yeah.
Well, one thing about Ed Murray sort of has always been this: let's plant it in stages. Let's do long term kind of work. So even this year, when the gun bill came up, and he was a sponsor, he said, "I have a knack or a tendency to go for things that take many years to pass. Mayoral elections take several months, so it's a different time frame than he's used to operating it on that." You know, Steinbrück will have probably less money, but he's got a name. You know, some people think he's a park. You know, there's a park named after his dad. And yeah, haven't I heard him. Steinbrück a lot? And, you know, isn't that a – so some people maybe can do better. Maybe they have enough name familiarity to need less money.
Well, Knut, you mentioned apostate on the arena. This we have to talk about that because that was a fascinating thing. Despite what a lot of people thought, on Monday, the NBA Relocation Committee, the official name of 7 owners who decide the fate of teams, announced that it was unanimously opposed to a plan to relocate the Sacramento Kings baseball team to Seattle. But that was not the final word. There's another final word. This is endless. So, I mean, if that's 7 of how many owners are there? I mean, what?
A couple dozen, probably more than that. But the way this plays out, so they have another vote on May 15th of all the owners. But that wouldn't even be the end of it, because now you have, I saw a tweet at least on this, that the Malou family only wants to sell to Chris Hansen. So what does he do? Does he proceed? Does he go ahead and buy him and keep him there?
Well, that's what your paper published today. He says, sort of reminded me of something we've already heard, which is, you know, let's just keep him there. I love it. I'm going to buy this team. Clay Bennett, anybody? I mean, does this not ring a bell?
What they may be counting on is this is at least one track I heard. What they may be counting on, I'm talking about the Hansen Group, is you buy it, you keep it in Sacramento, you wait till the voters really recognize how much public money is being proposed, and if anything falls through, then you say, sorry, I'm out of here, let's go to Seattle, and things change.
Another thing in your paper that was interesting this week was Danny Westneat had a column, I think it was this week, where he said, you know, Chris Hansen just too honest and nice.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of I like Danny Westneat's column on that very much. And in terms of the impact of this on the mayor's race, to the degree that Seattle feels like it's been screwed in this deal, I can say screwed on
I think
radio,
so, right?
I said it
get
twice.
The book
sorry.
Out. Get the book out.
The producers aren't paying attention. Right. It's come, it's gone.
Yeah, they're looking somewhere else. So to the extent that Seattle feels like it's been screwed by this, people will be looking for a fighter, which is what McGinn is for better and for worse. And the way he's positioned himself in this is as someone who's going to keep fighting along with Chris Hansen to get this team back to Seattle. And if, you know, Danny Westneat and a majority of Seattle want someone who doesn't always play nice, well, where have we heard that before? That's the description of McGinn that we get over and over as if it's a negative trait. But when Seattle wants someone who can actually go into a snake pit, as Westneat is saying, and, you know, bite the other snakes,
Well, somebody characterized Chris Hansen's Monday evening email as like, I'm going to take off my gentleman's Seattle gloves and duke it out.
Yeah, well, he'll probably have to deal with the NBA. And, you know, Seattle's more of a pushover than the NBA owners are on anything. And plus, he's got Steve Ballmer as part of his investment group. And I don't think anybody would think he was a shrinking violet or somebody that is not to be reckoned with. The scenarios that have been set up for how this could be salvaged, you know, are going to require a lot of toughness, and it's going to be probably going to be somewhat of a slog. So, for example, if
no pun intended, if,
NPI
read about it.
For example, he goes ahead and buys the Sacramento Kings. If he's prevented from buying the Sacramento Kings, he has the threat of an antitrust lawsuit because of restraining him from ownership, which they apparently can't do. So, there's the thing that he's lost. The thing that's been lost is the aura of inevitability.
Right.
If we had gotten the Sacramento Kings, it would be very difficult to derail the arena project. So the people who are against it, and this is whether it's support of Seattle or it's the Longshoremen's Union or
Peter Steinbrück
or whoever it is, people who are objecting in principle, they now have time. They have they've seen there's a stumble here. It's going to get messy. And I think they've seen now that they have opportunity to raise their issues, to get people to rethink, to change public opinion on the deal as it looks mushy. And certainly the NBA is not doing itself any favors with Seattleites generally in terms of impressing people here as a really great partner.
Were we impressed with the NBA? I mean, I don't think we've been impressed with the NBA for a while.
I think it's one of those things where when they kick you in the teeth once, you know, but you get kicked in the teeth a second time and it's like, you know, really over.
One thing that's going on here is that there is this sort of battle for an owner who's willing to pay the highest price ever paid for a basketball team. And that is pitched before the ownership committee and the other owners who will ultimately decide this, against the precedent of they tend not to like deals that don't have enough public money in them. And so the Seattle deal doesn't have as much public money as the Sacramento deal, and there's a fear of a precedent of less public money. So
they want public money in these deals?
Oh, absolutely. That's why they were so mad at Seattle and the
why
vote.
Is that?
I don't understand.
Because that's the game. That's the game that goes on year after year.
Yeah.
And so you've got this one guy willing to pay so much, and then over here you have, oh my gosh, it's sort of less or limited, viewed as
not. It's not a whole lot less.
It's not a whole lot less, but it's enough less that it's a precedent kind of concern.
The strategy of the owners in the cities is to offload as much risk onto the public as possible. So you offload the cost of these arenas and whatnot, which increases your bottom line and reduces the chance that anything will go wrong. Since Seattle voted to limit public subsidies of sports franchises at Key Arena, we became the poster child. And so now they
poster child for a bad city.
For a bad city, exactly. And so we lost our team, and the NBA can say to other cities, You want to have what happened in Seattle happen to you? You better cough up.
And just to translate for people who are following along at home and are mystified in the same way that I have been, bad deal in this context means a deal that is good for the citizens and the fans of a city.
Which makes me think I don't want any of your teams in my city.
Well, that's the vote behind 91 Initiative 91.
Wow.
And minutes after this, as you know, Milwaukee started to worry. Where is our new arena?
Wow. We're going to continue on with news of the week or the month or the day or whatever you want to talk about here on KUOW. Joni Balter, Knute Berger, Eli Sanders, I'm Marcy Silman. This is KUOW Seattle.
It's 57 degrees in Seattle. Clear blue sky, lots of sun. Forecast says it'll be sunny all day with a high of 72. Clear sky overnight, dropping to 49, then more sun tomorrow with a high of 77.
Join KUOW for the 42nd Annual Northwest Folklife Festival, May 24th through 27th at Seattle Center. In addition to music and dance, this year's festival includes a special program about the history and folklore of working in Washington State. Find out more on our events page at KUOW.org.
Writer Clyde Edgerton calls himself a COD, a considerably older dad.
I'm 68.
With three kids under the age of 10, he knows things, like install the car seat well before the baby arrives.
Well, it could take from 1 to 7 days to get that car seat in.
Papa Daddy gives advice later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
That's later today on KUOW's Afternoon News Magazine, which airs from 3 to 7 p.m.
Support for KUOW comes from STG, presenting comedian Jim Gaffigan at the Paramount Theater in Seattle. Tickets for this all-ages show are available now at the Paramount box office, 24-hour kiosks, or online at stgpresents.org.
It's 10:40. Amnesty International says that Syria's government and elements of its rebel movement are deliberately targeting journalists. More in our newscast in 20 minutes.
From KUOW Seattle, I'm Marcy Silman. Steve Scherer is on sabbatical till early fall. We're talking over the week's news with Eli Sanders, Knute Berger, and Joni Balter. We were talking about basketball, and before I leave the subject of sports, I was so interested in the reaction to NBA center or free agent Jason Collins' very public posting on Sports Illustrated's website and then picked up in the New York Times that he's gay, which makes him, and here's all the caveats, the first active professional athlete in one of the four major sports who's a male to come out as gay, because in fact, many women have come out and there have been folks, other men like Greg Louganis, who have come out as gay. But this is the first guy in one of these moneymaker sports to come out. So does that make it very brave?
Well, yes. Okay. And it's important because this is not expected of male professional athletes at that level. I mean, there was a lot of very good commentary on this that said, as you suggested, wait a minute, women in the WNBA have been out as lesbians for a long time. But there's a very good piece in The Atlantic that said, here's the difference. Women who are active in high-level sports are going according to the stereotype.
I was going to say everybody thinks they're gay already.
Exactly. So it's harder in the culture to go against type or against the stereotype, and that's why it's so difficult for NBA players to come out, because the stereotype of a gay man doesn't connect with in people's minds with the stereotype of an NBA athlete, and there's a problem, and it's other people's problems, as Jason...
Collins
was saying in his really, really wonderful piece in Sports Illustrated. There's also a very funny and also wonderful piece in The Stranger this week by Sherman Alexie,
yes,
a straight basketball player talking about his reaction to Jason Collins' announcement and the homoeroticism of sports and basketball in particular in general, and how he's processed it in the past and what he makes of this announcement. But I really highly recommend this piece. It was great.
Actually, the funniest part of it was, aside from swimming and diving, where men are wearing nothing basketball, they wear the next least amount of clothes. So you're always looking at naked men, and essentially everybody's looking at each other. A big question was Jason Collins is aging. A lot of sports commentators have pointed out he wasn't the best basketball player, and so he's a free agent now. And it's one thing, I mean, if he gets another team, everyone's like, well, what will happen? But he seemed to get lots of positive reinforcement on Twitter via
the president
the first lady. But also other players that may or may not be gay. We don't know.
Well, a former basketball player, Charles Barkley, I think made a really great point, which he said everybody in the NBA knows that they've played with gay players, and they know who those gay players are. So this isn't a shock to the players. It's this has been a long-term reality. So he said the issue is really in how the fans, the audience, the media, you know, how everyone else processes it. And I thought that he you know, I think his he made a just an argument for inclusion that I thought was, you know, very powerful, and I think this just, you know, is really important, and I think it's a way of sort of transforming some of the aspects of male culture. Most certainly in my generation, you know, most kids brought up in Little League locker rooms, Boy Scouts or whatever, the worst thing you could be called was gay. The worst thing you could be called was a wussy,
or other worse words.
Right. And whether you were gay or not, if there were behaviors that were stereotypical behaviors of gay men, it was held up by the coaches and by your locker room associates as a negative thing. And I think the idea of manhood is being redefined as something that's not about who you sleep with, but how you perform, you know, as an athlete. I think that will have long-term real benefits for everyone.
I thought that the piece was so poignant, the way he described, you know, discussing his news with various family members, all the way down to a twin brother.
Mm-hmm. I didn't know he had a twin brother.
That was so, like, they're twins. They are supposed to know everything about everything before the other person says it. And he had to have this moment with his brother to explain where he was. The piece was just powerful.
Yeah, I if you only saw coverage in mainstream press, you might want to read the Sports Illustrated blog essay. It's very long and detailed and very good. It got me to thinking, you know, we don't usually talk about sports, but tomorrow's the Kentucky Derby. And what's interesting about it is that there's a woman jockey and an African-American jockey for the first time, you know, really highly visible. And it's something I have been talking with people two people about this week, the fact that it seems like, you know, it might be just tokenism, but that barriers are ready to fall on many levels.
All over the place, you know.
So, I mean, I don't normally watch the Kentucky Derby, but...
Sounds like you're going to have your mint julep there, ready to go.
I may, indeed. I don't even know what time the Kentucky Derby's on, but...
It's in the afternoon, I don't remember.
But it'd be really... It's just really interesting to think about societal changes, and it just seems... The Jason Collins thing to me, as Knut was saying, you know, we have gay marriage. Yesterday, Rhode Island became the final New England state to officially approve gay marriage. I think that was a vote of the legislature, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, it was. Yes, it was.
And so it just seems like, you know, what was a trickle is starting to be this torrent that is unstoppable.
Well, I was just going to say, I mean, there's so much bad news. The areas here where these barriers are falling is really, really good news.
And Frank Bruni had a really wonderful column in the New York Times where he addressed another element of, you know, you're describing this torrent, but there's a kind of, I don't know if it's backlash is the right word, but a sentiment that's brewing of, you know, people saying, okay, we get it. We're for gay rights. Like, stop. We've heard so much about this. Like, let's turn the page in the culture. We're done with this. And
it's only some people, though.
Well, it's people who are progressive enough to be tired of it, but, you know, middle of the road enough that they're not on the activist side saying we need to push this all the way. And Frank Bruni's column was just wonderful. You know, he says we'll be quiet about this when we have equal rights. You want to stop hearing about this? Let all the barriers fall all across the country for gay citizens.
Well, let's talk about the aide to the Walla Walla State representative, I believe, who is one of the sponsors of a bill in the state legislature that would allow people to opt out of you know, a law that prohibits discriminations against gay men and lesbians. And I believe that this person was responding to an email from a citizen who complained that, you know, what if grocery stores stop serving? And the reply was something like, well, gay people can just grow their own food, something like that.
Yeah, that was an aide to a state.
Aide to a state lawmaker. So not everybody agrees that everything's...
That's kind of why it's not going to stop the discussion. It won't stop because... Even in a state that just passed gay marriage, we have a bill in the legislature that would allow the opt-out, as Marcy referred it, for religious reasons. Now, the bill's not going to pass. No.
It's no? Not. Are you guaranteeing that?
No. But
Well, it won't become law. It's not going to. It wouldn't pass the House.
Right, that's what I'm saying. Yeah. It won't pass. I mean, I don't think it'll pass the Senate either. No way.
And but, we should let people know the name of the senator who proposed this idiotic bill. Mike Hewitt of Spokane, I believe. He's a Republican.
No, I thought it was someone named Brown.
No, I'm pretty sure it's. We have it up on the slog today. Okay. An interview with the senator who.
I'm going to look. I'm looking it up. Just a second. So you're guaranteeing this isn't.
No, I didn't guarantee. But law. I just don't see it passing the Washington House. I don't see how. I don't think it'll pass the Washington Senate. But the reason people are still talking about it is because someone has introduced a bill and it has a little bit of. It has a few sponsors that you'll figure out.
Right. There are a number of senators who put their name on this thing, and it's terrible. And it's. I think one of the issues is that. When there's big change and we see it as having a lot of momentum, that doesn't mean it will last forever, and that doesn't mean there's not backlash. In fact, it guarantees there is backlash. And so, you know, you end slavery, but you get Jim Crow. You, did you see that the South Carolina signed into law this week passed a law and signed into law a nullification law saying that they can nullify federal law in South Carolina, including Obamacare. It's specifically about Obamacare. This is the issue that brought about the Civil War. And it's not dead. We have a state, you know, acting on my point is that you know, as rights expand, you're going to have backlash. You're going to have these kinds of things.
Washington State Senator Sharon Brown
of
Kennewick introduced
Senate
Bill 5927. It would allow businesses in Washington State to deny services to individuals based on religious or philosophical differences. So theoretically, somebody could not serve you because you're Muslim.
Yes,
I don't serve
Muslims. This is a reinstitution of the segregated lunch counter. Essentially, or being able to refuse, sir. You cannot do that. Constitutionally, you cannot do that. On those criteria.
Eli,
just to clarify, so that's the sponsor of the bill, but it was Senator Hewitt, Republican of Walla Walla.
And it wasn't him who said this.
Whose staffer made the comment about gays being able to just go and grow their own food.
And I'm assuming that aide doesn't have a job anymore.
If you're assuming that, you'd assume wrong.
He has his job still.
As far as I know, and Senator Hewitt is defending him. He's a very nice person in other contexts, is what's being said.
Well, let's talk a second, because the legislature concluded its regular session on Sunday. The gavel went down, and no budget, no bills. And this is an annual right now that we have this little short session or sometimes a long session. Sure. They don't get the work done. Everybody goes home. We come back.
This is a particularly, it's a long one to start with, but it's also a particularly, they didn't get very far.
It started
very slow. If you read the story about what's been accomplished and what's on the list to do, the to-do list is really, really long. It has budget, transportation, anything on guns.
Education budget.
Education. I mean, the list is so very long. So they're going to come back May 13th, and it's not quite starting over, but they have much to do.
How much does that cost the taxpayers? Special session. I'm looking it up.
Per diems for the folks who show up.
So does that imply that maybe we should, as opposed to having this citizen legislature that only works part-time, that we actually start having a legislature like a lot of other states do that, works year-round?
Or that we pay state legislators enough that, and this is the problem that we have on a lot of...
With the port as well.
Exactly. I was just going to say the port, but where we don't pay enough that people who can... get things done are attracted to the position. So, yeah, we could pay them more and maybe that would help. But, of course, the legislature is against paying anyone anymore as a whole. I think that there's a problem, to circle back around to the mayoral candidate forum for Ed Murray and all of this, in that he's at these candidate forums saying, I've shown in Olympia that I can get things done. And if you look over his long track record, that's true. But I'm not sure people have that much of an attention span or deep knowledge of legislative history in Olympia. And what they see in Olympia is nothing getting done. And they see the Senate, in which Ed Murray is supposed to be, herding cats very successfully, having flipped to Republicans in his time there. And when he's in a very powerful position in the Senate. So I think that unfortunately for him, events in Olympia undercut this argument from him that he can herd cats and be, you know, a legislative make the trains run on time legislatively. Right. It's been very hard for him to do that this year.
I'm curious about the role of the what do they call themselves, the majority caucus, majority
coalition,
Senate majority
Rodney Tom's group. That's the handful of Democrats that went over and sided with the Republicans. Has the effect been to just stop things from happening, or have they managed to get their agenda passed?
Well, think about that for a second. There are two things on the to-do list. The DREAM Act for young folks who were trying to get college aid, the extension of making sure that abortions are available under insurance. These are just two examples I'm using here. Is available from insurance companies that provide contraceptive care. So these were two things that supposedly were going to happen with the whole legislature. They got stuck in the Senate. They're not mandatory. They don't have to be done this second. But there was a letter signed by enough people in the Senate to make it happen. Get stuck in committee. So there has been that. Caucus coalition has had some troubles getting things that they said they were going to do finished, and that is part of the sort of, it's going to be a long tortured second session here.
How long it goes for? 30 days, and then they have the option to renew.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The ostensible reason that the caucus coup was formed was so that they could get a budget that would be. I mean, the rationale for it was that it would somehow break gridlock.
Mm-hmm.
It hasn't done that. And the other rationale for it was that this legislative session would all be about the budget. You know, these other issues aren't really important. Social issues and stuff. We're going to get away from that. We're really going to focus on the budget. And the marker that the Senate put down was we're going to increase spending to education, but we're not going to raise taxes, period. And that is not going to fly with the House. And so that's the impasse that they're going to have to resolve. And they're going to use these 2 weeks, to discuss, continue to discuss how to get to a budget place that they can pass.
Can I just say that they say that bit about let's just focus on the budget many a year. They said that last year, and then a huge amount of time and was spent on a big social issue, gay marriage, in the legislature. And so they said, well, we're only focusing on budget, but that happened too.
The other thing that has been interesting to watch is the reaction to a new governor. Jay Inslee has been accused by some people in the legislature of playing rougher politics than Chris Gregoire did.
Good. The legislature needs all the help it can getting things done. You know, I would point out that in terms of legislative inaction, of course, and social issues, we saw gun control go nowhere in the state legislature. And this week, I think it was, mm-hmm. come forward to say, fine, we're going to do this with or without the legislature. And we'll do an initiative to the people that will come through the legislature in 2014. And if the legislature doesn't act, which it has a propensity to not act, then the people will vote on this.
And that will be interesting as well.
It's interesting that they didn't pick this year, 2013, to do that because there's a calculation that has to be made. There is the rage of Newtown that won't stay at the level that it is for that long versus what they think might be a better electorate in 2014, which is the year they've selected.
Well, with that, we end this week's perusal of the news. Joni Balters, assistant political editor for the Seattle Times. Eli Sanders, associate editor at The Stranger. Are you guys both still on your sabbaticals?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Steve, he's on sabbatical somewhere else. Knute Berger.
I'm working.
And I
You're
am
working.
As well. Knute Berger, the Mossback at crosscut.com. Our show, produced by workers, Katie Sewell, Jason Pagano, Amina Al-Sadi, Bernard Ouellette is engineering. He's working. I'm Marcy Silman, and we're going to be back Monday morning at 9.
10:59. An update on President Obama's visit to Mexico in the news in a minute. KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Support for KUOW comes from Seattle Children's. Its new Cancer, Critical, and Emergency Care expansion, nicknamed Building Hope, provides more beds, advanced technology, and a healing family-centered environment for children and teens. More at seattlechildrens.org/buildhope.
Pat Sajak says he has the best job in the world, but the Wheel of Fortune host didn't start out as a fan of game shows.
Honestly, I didn't see myself as a game show host. Nothing against it, but if I were to make a list of the 50 things I thought I'd end up doing in broadcasting, game show host would have been 47.
Pat Sajak on 30 years of Wheel of Fortune, Sunday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
Sunday morning here on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Join KUOW for a live broadcast of Garrison Keillor's A Prairie Home Companion on Saturday, June 15th at Chateau San Michel Winery in Woodinville. Learn more and find ticket information on the events page at KUOW.org.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.